Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, tax breaks. Specifically, one that was written into the 2017 Republican tax bill. President Trump said it would help poor communities, but it's turned into a windfall for the wealthy. My guest, Jesse Drucker, reports on taxes for the New York Times. He joined me to explain how an idea meant to reduce poverty ended up lining the pockets of the rich, and what it says about President Trump's tax overhaul. Jesse Drucker, you recently wrote a piece about a part of the Republicans' tax cut bill that was supposed to help the poor, but it hasn't. Tell me about it.
The 2017 Tax Act had a number of significant provisions. Tax cuts, which overwhelmingly were benefiting very wealthy people. But one that did not get very much attention at the time was something called Opportunity Zones. And what Opportunity Zones are it's a new law, part of the Tax Act from 2017, that permitted all 50 states and Puerto Rico to nominate thousands of census tracts around the country. You know, each state nominated tracts in their state, and then would then be approved by the Treasury Department, which would then be eligible for special treatment in the following way. If you are an individual that had capital gains income, in other words, income from selling off a business or selling off stock or, you know, a hedge fund making trades, you had capital gains income, you could take that income and invest it in a real estate project or a business in one of those newly designated zones, and you would get two tax benefits from doing that. The first one is that you would get a deferral of up to 7 years of your original tax bill. In other words, I sell my stock in Apple, I take that money, I invest it in a project and opportunity zone. Instead of paying my tax bill, now I get up to 7 years before I have to pay it. And I actually, when I do pay it, I pay it at a discount. So that's the first benefit. The bigger benefit, though, is that if my money stays in that project for at least a decade and that project gets sold for a profit, that is completely tax-free to me.
Tax-free, totally.
Correct.
Tax-free.
Totally tax-free, correct. No capital gains taxes at all on the sale of that 10 years down the line. And so the theory behind the legislation is that the census tracts that were designated were areas that were overwhelmingly poor. And that is correct. The vast majority of these tracts are low-income parts of the country. And the theory is that this would provide an incentive for people to make investments in these areas, which in turn would create jobs and housing and businesses and economic growth. What has happened so far is two things. One is that a number of the projects that have been invested in are projects that were underway in many cases for years before the legislation existed. So what's happening is people are getting a tax break for something that real estate developers were going to do anyway. The second thing is that although the majority of these census tracts are low income, a significant number of them are not. And what has happened is that we are seeing sizable investments in projects in parts of the country that are either not low income or are rapidly gentrifying, and projects that are things like boutique hotels or luxury apartment buildings that are not, I think, pretty clearly benefiting low-income people.
So Anthony Scaramucci's development in New Orleans is one of the examples of how this tax break worked.
Yeah, so that's actually sort of a perfect example. I mean, Anthony Scaramucci, who briefly worked for the White House, his fund raised money and invested money in a Virgin Hotels hotel project in the Warehouse District in New Orleans. Now, you know, New Orleans, which is a city which has, you know, serious problems with poverty and with violent crime. If you've ever been to the Central Business District or part of the Central Business District or the Warehouse District, this is not one of those areas. This is a rapidly gentrifying, and I would probably go so far as to say a completely gentrified part of that city that is filled with boutique hotels and high-end restaurants and hipster coffee shops and hipster barber shops. And what has happened is that part of the city has been designated an opportunity zone. And so the result is that you kind of see the example of the two things that we were talking about earlier. One, this is a project that was underway for long before the legislation was enacted. And secondly, it's a part of the city where I think you can really question why a tax break is needed to incentivize investment in a project there.
There's another one you've written about, and that's in downtown Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, so that's actually sort of simple. I mean, that part of Portland has been designated an opportunity zone, and there is a Ritz-Carlton, you know, basically about as high-end a hotel as you can get, that's been underway for a long time. And that is eligible for Opportunity Zone funding. And the people raising money are raising money through an opportunity fund to get money for that project.
So President Trump said all of this would actually benefit the poor. And it turns out, from what you describe, it's actually benefiting the wealthy.
Well, so I guess I would say a couple things about that. I mean, first of all, President Trump has sort of taken up this issue over the past month or so and has mentioned opportunity zones repeatedly in speeches and on Twitter. But, the sort of origin of opportunity zones does not come with Donald Trump. It actually comes in part. One of the main people responsible for it is one of the people who hopes to succeed him, Cory Booker, a U.S. senator from New Jersey and a Democrat. I mean, I guess, the defenders of the tax cut would basically say a couple things. They would say, one, it's really too early to tell, how this is going to play out. That, yes, a lot of the kind of low-hanging fruit projects that we're seeing getting funding, maybe this is not ideal. But eventually there, not just eventually, but that there are some projects, and whether it's in Erie, Pennsylvania, or in Baltimore or Charlottesville, Virginia, places where there are, projects in low-income parts of the country that actually are targeting low-income people, that actually are happening, and that more are expected to come in the future. That's the first thing. The second thing, I think what people would say is that the argument would be, well, even a project that isn't directly targeting low-income people, that may not be in a low-income part of the country, that any incentive to stimulate investment creates jobs and, construction jobs and jobs in some of these projects will benefit, not just wealthy people, but people who are low-income people as well. And, there's actually sort of a third thing I just wanted to say on the opportunity zones. We're kind of talking about the ways that are fairly obvious that this cut is benefiting upper-income people, luxury projects in affluent parts of the country. But, one thing to keep in mind is that you're only eligible to take part in this and to potentially get this tax benefit if you have capital gains income. That's a type of income that a very small percentage of Americans have, and it's disproportionately extremely wealthy people. So in other words, you really can only be a wealthy person to kind of get in the club, so to speak. I mean, we wrote about, the big Swiss bank UBS is raising money for some opportunity zone projects. And one of the qualifications in at least one of the projects was that in order to be an investor to take advantage of this break, you had to have at least $50 million in investable assets. So the point is that it's a break that is really only available to very wealthy people to begin with.
So now tell me more about these opportunity zones. There are nearly 31 million people who live in those zones that are considered poor.
There's no question that the vast majority of the opportunity zones are poor parts of the country. There's no question about that. The opportunity zones that are upper income or that are rapidly gentrifying are a small minority of the actual zones. But they appear to be a disproportionate number of the zones that are actually having projects funded in them, if that makes sense. In other words, if you look at a map and you see what's been designated, you will see zones that jump out at you as raising real questions about why they were designated. The majority of the tracts do not fall into that category. The majority of the tracts are clearly poor areas. The issue, though, is that we are seeing lots of projects and investments in the ones that are not poor and seeing less in the ones that are low income.
When we come back, more from Jevsey Drucker.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Jevsey Drucker. He is a reporter at the New York Times covering taxes and international business. How come the money is not reaching the target audience? I mean, is this mismanagement or is it something else?
I've heard people describe this as a new program, a government program. It's not a program. The only government oversight has to do with the drawing of the zones, you know, where the money is yeah. eligible to be invested. And then there are lots of very extremely kind of technical regulations from the Treasury Department about how the investments work and how the funds have to operate from a tax perspective. Unbelievably kind of technical and arcane. But there's no oversight from the government, and there's no sort of direction from the government about where the money goes. It's essentially the market deciding where the money goes. And so if you are an investor looking to make money, and this is a tax break that applies to profitable ventures, any investor is going to think about where it's easiest to make money. And it's kind of common sense that it's going to be easiest to make money in a more affluent area, in a project that's maybe less risky. And so essentially what the Opportunity Zone tax break, because again, we can't call it a program, it's leaving it up to the investor community to determine where the money goes. You're essentially leaving it up to the goodwill of the profit-seeking investment community to do projects that have some social benefit. And there are some projects out there like that. But for the majority of real estate investors, that's not how they think of projects. The majority of real estate investors are not so-called impact investors. They're not seeking necessarily a higher social good beyond making money. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but that's just the reality of how the investment world operates.
And those who would defend these projects would point to a development in Birmingham, Alabama.
Sure, in Birmingham or in Baltimore or in Erie, Pennsylvania. I mean, yes, there clearly are projects. But, you know, I can tell you, when I did speak to someone who is kind of from the impact investment community, you know, the community where they are seeking investors who are interested in projects not just to make money, but projects that they hope will have some social impact. And what he said was, you know, the project that he was working on that was in an opportunity zone that he considered to be a socially impactful project, you know, what he said was you had to be very mindful of that as the goal kind of every step of the way. In other words, what he was saying is you can't simply just, okay, we're going to designate these zones and people are now going to be incentivized because of a tax break to put in money and now social good will follow. Like, it doesn't really work that way. You have to have socially minded investors to make something like that work in the way that the defenders of the project say it's going to. And that's the reality of the world. That's not the majority of investors. And again, like I say, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just if in the world of people who are seeking to make money in real estate projects, that's just not how it works. That's not how they're thinking.
So you have to have either socially minded investors or government oversight to make sure that the money is going where it should be going.
I mean, there are critics of the break who would say that this is basically fundamentally flawed, that if the goal is to say, OK, we're going to designate some poor areas and kind of keep our fingers crossed that people are going to put money in those areas because of a tax break, that that's not really the best way to do economic development in challenged parts of the country. You know, there's another aspect of this that we actually haven't really discussed, which is, you know, one of the concerns and one of the criticisms of the Opportunity Zone concept is that, you know, you have areas across the country, whether they're here in New York City or in Los Angeles or in San Francisco, that are, you know, where you see kind of rapid gentrification, you know, areas where you would have low-income neighborhoods, you know, potentially stable low-income neighborhoods that are we're now seeing kind of rapid acceleration in real estate prices and the displacement of low-income people. And the concern is that the Opportunity Zones will lead to an acceleration of those forces. And, you know, many of the projects that we identified kind of fit right in that vein, you know, areas that 10 years ago, you know, might have been kind of pretty bleak, have been pretty rapidly gentrified over the last 10 or 20 years. Those have been designated Opportunity Zones. And now the expectation is that is going to accelerate the gentrification, which will in turn push out the remaining low-income people living in those areas.
So you're talking about these Opportunity Zones, but what about the actual tax cuts that President Trump promised to the middle and lower classes?
Well, I mean, it's all, you know, it's all happened. I mean, it's now we're nearly 2 years in the past. You know, the reality is that these were tax cuts that overwhelmingly and disproportionately benefited higher income people, both in terms of rate cuts and also, you know, the most significant one for high income people was the cut in the corporate tax rate and some other benefits that were provided to corporations. And those all sort of wildly disproportionately benefit upper income people.
It sounded to me when the president talked about these tax cuts, he said that all the money from the tax cuts for corporations were going to go into plowing back money into greater job growth, higher wages, more investment in areas, and this is obviously the Opportunity Zones. But, I mean, what happened to those ideas about the tax cuts?
Well, I'm not really sure those were ideas. I mean, that's what he said, but that was never the reality of what was in the legislation. I mean, it was never remotely the reality.
You're saying he said that, but...
Well, let me sort of go back and clarify, I guess, what I was saying. I can't, unfortunately, really speak authoritatively to, you know, sort of research on what has happened to money saved from the tax cuts and how that has translated into investment and into jobs. We know that companies have been spending enormous amounts of money on share buybacks, which obviously benefits upper income people. I guess what I'm referring to is what the tax cut bill was. I mean, it was a tax cut bill that was disproportionately and overwhelmingly targeted upper income people.
And what about the Trump administration's talk about future tax cuts? He talked about payroll taxes for a while.
I mean, I guess the most significant potential change, if it actually happens, would be something that would index capital gains to inflation. In other words, that you wouldn't actually pay capital gains tax based on just the nominal gain. You know, if you buy a house for, you know, $100,000 and sell it 10 years later for $150,000, what they would do is and that's not a great example because there's an exemption there to begin with, but you would not just look at the nominal change in the value of your asset when you sell it, but you would compare that to inflation. I mean, the issue with that is there's all sorts of gamesmanship that can be – all sorts of games that can be played in terms of borrowing. You know, if you kind of borrow at one interest rate and then you're paying capital gains at another interest rate, basically you have a way to effectively completely eliminate your capital gains tax. The other issue, of course, which is not strictly tax policy, is it's just, you know, you would basically take a you would take a tax that is disproportionately borne by the wealthy and index that to inflation when we don't, you know, when we haven't done anything similar, say, to the minimum wage. It's just sort of interesting that the one that they would choose to do that with would be the one that benefits very high income people.
Jesse Drucker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Yurev-Litker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.